Georgia predict up to 10 inches of rain could saturate the region by midweek, needed relief for an area hoping to replenish its water reservoirs. Since last week, Fay has dumped heavy amounts of rainfall in the southeast, especially in Florida. Some areas of that state are under several feet of water from a storm that made landfall a record 4 times before moving out. Fay is responsible for 13 deaths in the United States, 11 in Florida. For NPR News, I'm Edgar Tragetz in Atlanta.
Tropical storm warnings remain in effect for parts of Mexico's Baja California Peninsula because of Tropical Storm Julio. More than 2,500 families fled their homes yesterday. The storm is expected to weaken to a tropical depression later today. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Chevy. 8 models with 30 mpg on the highway, including Cobalt XFE Coupe with 36, based on EPA estimates. Chevy.com.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, presenting the 18th Annual CAS Lecture, Searching for Unconventional Superconductors, A Quantum Map Quest, by Dale J. Van Harlington, on Tuesday, September 9th at 7:30 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum, online at www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about relations between Indian tribal governments and the U.S. government, that in a larger sense. But very specifically, we'll be talking about how that relationship determines law enforcement and the ability, particularly, of tribal authorities to charge people with crimes that are committed on Indian reservations. And here's a case in point. 1 in 3 American Indian women will be raped in her lifetime. More than 80% of the victims identify their attackers as non-Indian, and that makes it very unlikely they will ever be prosecuted because federal law does not allow Indian tribal courts to try non-Indians. We'll be talking a little bit about closing the gap between these two legal systems this morning with our guest, Bruce Dutoux. He is professor of law at Vermont Law School. That's in South Royalton, Vermont. And he is an internationally recognized scholar on Native American issues, including tribal sovereignty and federal recognition of Indian tribes. He is an enrolled member of the Houma tribe of Louisiana. Started out his career as a trial attorney. Then he served for a number of years at Dartmouth, where he was an undergraduate, as director of the college's Native American program. That was until 1989. He also was associate dean of freshmen and director of the intensive academic support program. And then in 1991, he joined the regular faculty at Vermont Law School. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief in their comments so we can get in as many as possible. But callers are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you're certainly welcome to call. Professor Dutoux, hello.
Good morning. How are you, David?
I'm fine. Thank you. And yourself?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Well, we appreciate you talking with us today. Our attention was certainly grabbed by the piece that you, op-ed piece that you wrote a couple of weeks ago that appeared in the New York Times for a number of reasons, for the kind of statistics that have to do with sexual assault, first of all, which are shocking and very saddening, and also for the basic point, and I think it's something that perhaps people would be quite surprised about if they hadn't heard it before, and that is, as I have outlined it, and I hope that I did that correctly, that essentially that is the case, that tribal courts are barred by federal law from trying non-Indians if they commit crimes against Indians or on an Indian reservation. Have I got that right?
Yes, you have.
This is something that, as I say, surprised me as much as we have tried from time to time to talk a little bit about Indian law and about the relationship between Indian tribes and the U.S. government. I'm not sure that this is something that I had come across. And I expect that, as I said, that most people would, when you say that, they'd say, really? Can that possibly be true?
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of very basic reactions that I think most people have when They encounter tribes dealing with any kind of governmental issues, and this goes back to even my years teaching classes with students who, for whom this is all very new. And the two reactions are this. One, they are often surprised to know that Native tribes in the U.S. have a very distinct legal status as governments. For many Americans, I wouldn't say most Americans, but perhaps even most Americans, have a view of Native peoples as among the kinds of ethnic or minority groups that exist in the U.S., like African Americans, Asian Americans, Latinos, etc. The distinctive feature of Indian tribes is that they also have a unique legal status as governments. And that goes back to the Constitution, where tribes are specifically mentioned in the Constitution, in Article 1, as among the sovereign bodies with whom Congress can regulate commerce. So in the Article 1, there's a provision that says Congress regulates commerce with the foreign nations, the several states, and the Indian tribes. And that's a specific reference to tribes occupying a status as a government body. So that's reaction number one, is that to familiarize people with the view that tribes have a government status and, like most governments, are interested in issues like law and order within their territories. The second issue is one that sadly delves into issues of racism and opposition or hostility, and that is that given that tribes do have some governmental authority over people, including non-Indians in certain regulatory areas, if not law enforcement, that sort of breeds a kind of hostility or skepticism as to whether or not tribes will be fair to people who are not members of that community. And so the phenomena itself, sexual violence against Indian women in particular, is a related fallout from that, where many folks are simply unaware of conditions within Indian country. And this issue was brought to light, the phenomena of astronomical rates of sexual violence against Indian women, in two recent reports, one of which was from the government itself. The Department of Justice produced a study that I relied on for the New York Times op-ed that was published in 2004 that contained much of this information. And a follow-up report was done by Amnesty International that was published just last year called Maze of Injustice. And readers or listeners can go onto the Amnesty website to read the entire document. That has first-person accounts from survivors of the violence that describe the frustration that many of them feel when they either call and find that there is a confusion among law enforcement as to what to do. You know, was the offender a non-Indian or a tribal member? Was the offense committed on tribal lands? All of these questions before the, you know, what happened and who was he, et cetera, to establish who has the jurisdictional authority. And part of the Amnesty report was that given the years of frustration among many survivors of sexual assaults, there's this notion that there simply is not going to be much of a response from anyone given this jurisdictional confusion. And I should note, David, right off the bat, that many areas that tribes are working very productively with states and the federal government to address this issue. And so what we do see are pockets where there is a higher degree of responsiveness among those three sovereigns to try to tease things out, to even share authority with Indian tribes, to be able to have their law enforcement officers cross-deputized so that at a minimum they are allowed to respond to calls to stop the violence that's occurring, or to at least detain an alleged offender so that the federal or state authorities can come in and take over a possible prosecution. So I do want to give acknowledgement to those places that are doing something quite positive and proactive about this. But the picture that emerges from both the Amnesty report and the Department of Justice statistics, and frankly my own knowledge based on years of contact with Indian country, I'm from a tribal community myself, I know that the picture is pretty bleak for victims of sexual violence.
Yeah. I understand that there was quite a reaction to the piece that you wrote when it was published in a couple of weeks ago, and it seemed that a lot of the reaction was from people who were saying, oh, it can't possibly be that bad.
That's exactly right. The respondents fell into a number of discrete camps. There was one camp that clearly took issue with the stats. They just simply couldn't believe that the picture was that bleak. You know, where did these numbers come from? And some readers even wrote me privately, and to those who did write me privately, I did respond and cited them to the Department of Justice report as well as to Amnesty's. There was another category of respondents who were simply of the view that perpetuating tribal governments, that is, enhancing the role of tribes, as I suggest in the piece, was creating some form of apartheid in the U.S. That is, why should we go in the direction of strengthening tribal governments? What we should be doing is essentially putting more and more of the responsibility on the feds and the states, and essentially dissolving tribal governments. And to those readers who wrote to me firsthand about that, I said, you know, that policy was actually tried. It was called the termination policy in the 1950s and early 60s, when Congress essentially terminated the sovereign status of over 100 Indian tribes, including many from the Great Lakes area, the Menominee tribe being the largest tribe that was terminated. And so that effectively ended their status as a government and subjected people to state and local law. That's how some respondents felt. And a third and last category of respondents were people who were simply hostile to the idea that Native tribes could be trusted to be fair to non-Indians. You know, their view was that they had had encounters with Indian country themselves, usually one encounter in Indian country, and I was amazed at how easily people could universalize that and say that is an indictment across all of the 563 federally recognized Indian tribes, because, you know, they may have had one bad experience and would then say tribes are incompetent or corrupt or both and should not be trusted to do something as serious as engage in criminal prosecution where people's liberty is at stake.
Does how common is it that you find non-Indians committing serious crimes on Indian reservations? Here we have, this is obviously very, when you talk about sexual assault, it's very disturbing, and we have very significant numbers there. Altogether, are the numbers of serious crimes committed by non-Indians on reservations, is that a significant number?
Well, it is a significant number in the sense that non-Indians make up a significant cohort of residents on some Indian reservations, and that's a classic result of 19th century or early 20th century federal policies that opened up Indian lands to homesteading. The idea back then was to assimilate Native peoples into the fabric of American society, and one way to do that was to simply end reservations and open them up to non-Indian homesteaders. Congress abandoned that policy, but left the non-Indians population on the reservations, and it was only decades later that we start getting some answers to the questions as to the scope of tribal authority over these non-Indians. I don't have numbers, David, in terms of whether the rates of offending are higher for non-Indians in Indian country. What I do know is that there are significant numbers of non-Indians who are on Indian lands, as well as tribal people, both categories of which commit crimes. And it falls to either the federal government or the states or the tribes, depending upon where the crime was committed, what is the nature of the crime. For example, there's a federal law called the Major Crimes Act that gives the federal government jurisdiction if it's an Indian offender. And in a few instances, states have been given the primary responsibility, basically Congress handing over the authority to certain states to be the chief prosecuting authority. So it's a very complex jurisdictional picture, and the problem of enforcement is not just unique to sexual violence. It arises in other contexts in terms of who will be the responsible prosecuting power, what are the limits on that power, and again, what can the tribe do to play a part and in lowering crime rates in Indian country.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Bruce Dutu. He's professor of law at Vermont Law School. That's in South Royalton, Vermont. He is a scholar of Native American issues, including tribal sovereignty and federal recognition of Indian tribes. And we're talking this morning about this curious gap in the legal relationship between the tribal governments and the government of the United States and what that means for prosecuting people who commit crimes on Indian reservations. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk some more about how it is that, because it was not always the case that Indian tribes lacked this kind of sovereignty to prosecute crimes committed on Indian land, that there would have been a time when they did, or at least some tribes claimed and did exercise that authority. That, as you say, began to change as the U.S. government started to take a different position towards tribal governments. One thing in particular I'm interested in having you talk about is Oliphant v. Suquamish tribe. This is a decision of the Supreme Court that you write about in this particular piece really formalized this condition that we have talked about, that is that tribes can't prosecute non-Indians. Well, what was that case about?
Well, Oliphant arose in the mid-1970s, and I gave just a very brief description of the facts in the op-ed. And so for listeners who did not have a chance to read that op-ed, essentially the case arose when two non-Indian residents of the Suquamish Reservation, which is on a peninsula across from Seattle in the state of Washington, two individuals were arrested by tribal police officers. One for disturbing the peace and striking a law enforcement officer. He hit one of the tribal cops. And the other one engaged in a high-speed chase throughout the reservation and ended up plowing into a tribal police car. So he was brought up on charges of, destruction of property. And what was interesting about their litigation strategy is that they did not appear in tribal court. They were both cited to appear in the tribe's court, but instead they took advantage of a provision in federal law that dates back to 1968 called the Indian Civil Rights Act. In that law, Congress imposed many, if not most, of the key provisions of the Bill of Rights and imposed that on Indian tribes, basically saying when a tribe exercises authority over any person, and that includes non-Indians, they must be provided with this menu of very important rights, among them due process of law and equal protection of the tribe's laws. Well, there's a provision in that law, the Indian Civil Rights Act, that allows an individual to file a writ of habeas corpus in federal court. Basically, that's a ticket into federal court to say that something is not going well or right in tribal court. My rights are not being respected. That the assumption had been for 10 years that could only be brought by someone who could point to errors in the prosecution or errors in the systems, the processes that a tribe had employed in a particular instance. What Mr. Oliphant and the companion person, Daniel Bellegard, what they did is instead they weren't challenging any particular wrong act on the part of the tribe. They actually challenged the very existence of tribal authority over them as non-Indians. And that, as you can imagine, elevated the stakes of that controversy. So they were able to go into federal court and have a federal court review the issue as to whether or not the Suquamish, and by extension, all Indian tribes, have authority over non-Indians. Now, both the federal judge, the district court, and the Court of Appeals ruled in favor of the tribe on the jurisdictional issue. And the message that Mr. Oliphant got was, you need to go back to tribal court and answer to their laws. And if, in the process of being prosecuted under tribal law, your rights under the Indian Civil Rights Act are somehow violated, then, and only then, could you go into the federal courts to have some sort of review. Well, that case then goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in 1978, the court in a 6-2 decision. There was one justice who didn't participate in the decision, Justice Brennan. The majority ruled that Indian tribes did not have authority, criminal jurisdictional authority over non-Indians. When I teach the Oliphant class, I tell my students it's one of the least complicated issues to discuss. It's a very straightforward proposition. Can an Indian tribe prosecute a non-Indian? The answer is also very straightforward. No. As in many of these issues, though, the reasoning of the court is the key controversy about Oliphant. Many of us regard Oliphant as one of the, if not the most controversial decision by the Supreme Court in Indian law in the modern era. And it's that reasoning. The court employed some highly dubious reasoning, versions of history, interpretations of the law, including legal provisions that had been repealed or withdrawn, to basically rule that tribes had lost the power to prosecute non-Indians. Now, they recognize that tribes historically had exercised full authority, but that after coming under the authority of the United States government, somehow their status as a limited sovereign had consequences. Now, this is one that had not been clarified by the courts for, you know, from 1789 until 1978. You would think that we would have had an answer to this question long before 1978. And yet the court has to delve into a lot of 19th century precedents to come up with the answer that it came up with. So that's the answer. And a few years later, the court had the opportunity to rule as to whether or not tribal authority existed, criminal authority, existed over non-member Indians. So let's say if you had a member of the Lakota Nation committing an offense on the Navajo Nation, there, again, you had a similar legal challenge there, and initially the court ruled that, as in Oliphant, the non-member Indian, as they're called in the law, were political outsiders to the tribe and therefore were not subject to the tribe's criminal jurisdiction. Now you had two categories of offenders who were out of reach of the tribe's criminal authority, non-Indians as a result of Oliphant and non-member Indians as a result of this other case from 1990. What was interesting, David, is that just a few months after this second decision, which was known as Duro versus Reyna, it arose from Arizona, shortly after that decision was handed down, tribal communities and their advocates petitioned the Congress and lobbied for some change in legislation to overrule that decision. They obviously wanted Oliphant overruled as well, but that didn't happen, and there's a political reason for that. Member of the Senate at the time, who was in charge of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, had been the former Attorney General of the state of Washington, and his office had brought the Oliphant case. And now this person is a U.S. senator who did not want to see Oliphant swept away as a precedent, and he made it very clear that no bill in the U.S. Senate would see the light of day if it included a provision to overrule Oliphant. And so the Congress legislatively overruled only the Duro case and restored tribal authority to prosecute non-member Indians. So now you get this really bizarre jurisdictional framework where the tribes can certainly prosecute their own members. The court had made that very clear. They could prosecute non-member Indians, but only because the Congress wrote a law saying so. But they could not still prosecute non-Indians. Now, if your listeners have a headache, just listen to all of that. imagine what my poor law students feel, and more importantly, the people in Indian country who have to sort through this morass to figure out who has authority and precisely why. If a power has been lost, how exactly was it lost? And those raise some very troubling issues about the scope, not just of tribal power, but a federal authority to manage the issues like the power of Indian tribes. Where does the court, where does the Congress presume to have that authority? Again, I mentioned earlier that the status of Indian tribes as sovereign governments can be traced back to the language of the Constitution. Well, a close reading of the Constitution says that Congress is empowered to regulate commerce with the Indian tribes, not of the Indian tribes. And so the language denotes a kind of bilateralism that suggests that if there will be any changes in the scope of the tribe's power, that they will be brought about through negotiations. And for most of our experience in the historical relations between tribes and the federal government, that was done through treaties to resolve land claims and even scope of jurisdictional issues. Well, in 1871, Congress wrote a law that ended treaty making with Indian tribes and brought them under the regular legislative authority of the Congress so they could be subject to ordinary statutes as opposed to the formalities of treaty making. So members of the modern court have expressed concern about whether or not Congress indeed has the authority that it has long exercised, and whether that can be grounded in the rights of the Constitution. So this issue raises not just the scope of authority that tribes possess, but implicates deeper matters, as I just noted, the scope of Congress's power under the Constitution.
I have a caller here I want to get to, and just to make one quick point, just to make sure people understand that as Congress wrote this law that said that Indian tribal governments have the authority to prosecute non-members if they commit crimes on the reservation, the Congress could come in, also step in and write a law that says that Indian tribal governments have the authority to prosecute anyone.
Correct.
So this is something that could be changed by the Congress if the members of Congress decided that it was something important to do.
That's correct, and that's the position that I take in the op-ed, or at least that's the suggestion I make in the op-ed. And there was not time in the op-ed to go into the nuances of what exactly would be the constitutional fallout from that. Are there any limits on the power of Congress to do exactly that? And there are at least some members of the current Supreme Court who have already expressed some concern and, frankly, some doubt as to whether or not Congress does have the constitutional authority to place U.S. citizens in front of criminal tribunals who do not have the limitations of the Bill of Rights imposed on them. These are related to the issues that we saw coming out of the Guantanamo Bay litigation, where you had military tribunals and other tribunals passing on claims of liberty, and whether or not Congress could authorize those kinds of actions in the context of Indian tribes. So I think there would be some very significant constitutional concerns that could be expressed, although the majority of the court, which upheld this legislation that overruled the Duro case, the majority of the court found that Congress, in fact, did have the authority and does have the authority to make these kinds of changes in the scope of tribal authority. So I think such a law would be upheld, but there would probably be some very strong dissenting views on that opinion.
Let me introduce very quickly again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Bruce Dutoux. He's professor of law at Vermont Law School. That's in South Royalton, Vermont. His area of scholarship is Native American issues, tribal sovereignty, federal recognition of Indian tribes. He is an enrolled member of the Houma tribe of Louisiana and has, in addition to teaching at Vermont, was on faculty at Dartmouth for a number of years. In 1986, he went back there where he had been an undergrad and served as director of the college's Native American program until 1989, was also associate dean of freshmen and director of the intensive academic support program. And then in 91, he joined the faculty at Vermont. And we're talking here about Indian law and the relationship between the governments of the tribes and the governments of the United States. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller in Urbana to talk with on our line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. As both you and David mentioned, the political will has to be there to bring about these changes that will bring more equity to handling the kinds of crimes that you talk about. And I just wanted to mention that there's one small glimmer that we might be heading in that direction, and that is that Dr. David Gipp, who is president of United Tribes Technical College and is a member of the Standing Rock Tribe, will be speaking tomorrow at 3 to 3:30 at the Democratic National Convention, which is one of the rare events where a Native American has been chosen to speak in this sort of venue. It's usually a more exclusive process rather than an inclusive process, and I sort of take this as a nice step in the right direction.
Well, Professor Dutu, you have some reaction to that?
I think that's great news. I actually was not aware of that. Could you remind us when he's scheduled to speak?
Right. It's Dr. David Gipp, who's president of the United Tribes Technical College. Mm-hmm. He'll be speaking at the Democratic National Convention tomorrow, Tuesday, between 3 and 3:30 p.m.
Great. Well, I do hope people turn in for that, and I agree. I'm sorry, what's your name, the person calling in?
Well, you can give your name if you like. We generally don't ask people for their names.
Well, I just wanted to thank the caller for that information, because it is something that that is an issue that has arisen in recent years, recent months, in fact, in terms of which of these two presidential candidates bring forth a platform that would be more supportive of tribal sovereignty. And, of course, the Obama campaign very early on put forth a very positive, very supportive platform in terms of recognizing the scope of authority of Indian tribes, and a particular plank that deals with enlarging the jurisdictional authority of Indian tribes so that they would have full authority within their territories.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much, then, for calling and tell us about that. And other questions and comments are also welcome, by the way. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, I recognize, Professor Dutu, that this is a complicated matter, but I'm afraid I must confess, even having tried to get an understanding of this and talked about it a couple of times, I still find myself being very confused about exactly what is the status of the tribe, of a tribe, and the status of the reservation vis-a-vis the United States. Mm-hmm. When one, as a non-Indian, if I step onto an Indian reservation, it's not as if I've gone into stepped into another country,
right?
And I'm still in the United States, and yet there, the relationship between those people and that land, and the people on the land that are on the other side of that line, clearly is different. And it's something that I guess I find very difficult to try to understand.
It is very, very difficult to understand, and I think we're just beginning to see more attention given to this issue by other scholars beyond legal scholars. For example, political philosophers, political scientists are finally beginning to turn their attention in significant numbers to this precise issue. And let me just go back to a phrase that I used or to a case that I referenced from the 19th century. In the 1831, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in a pair of cases involving the Cherokee Nation, used the phrase domestic dependent nations to describe the precise legal status of Indian tribes. Domestic dependent nations. Now, there's a lot of information submerged within those three little words that connote a very unique status. Basically, a nation within a nation status. Now, here's the other piece that listeners have to keep in mind. Many of those decisions and a lot of the language that was used both by the courts and by the Congress, basically the rulemakers of the day, were written by people who shared the conventional wisdom of the day, which was that tribes as a community, as a people, were actually not going to be around for very long. In my book that came out recently, I refer to this as the dying Indian thesis, the notion that Native peoples were a dying race, and all the the particulars of scope of authority, how do we balance relations between tribes and Indian federal government and the states, how do we manage all of that with some sort of principled, in some sort of principled way. Many folks harbored the view that this would be an issue of a short-term nature because tribes were essentially dying out. Well, tribes didn't die out. And hence one of the reasons why Congress shifted gears dramatically in the late 19th century towards a policy of assimilation was to accelerate what had been viewed as the inevitable, that Indian tribes would in fact all die out and their members would become totally assimilated within the fabric of American society. There would not be a need to wrestle with this conundrum of political pluralism. We're quite used to thinking about cultural pluralism in the U.S., that is the melting pot, or at least the salad, you know, where you have discrete minorities from different groups, and we encourage people to retain their languages, their traditions, and so forth. But when it comes to political authority, the conventional view is that there is one nation, you know, one nation under God type of notion, not two bodies of laws. And that's the challenge that Indian tribes pose. You have prior sovereigns, the first sovereigns to occupy North America, or lands that became the U.S., still exercising that primordial sovereignty to have a settler community arrive and essentially over time become this the dominant society, including with their government structures. What room is there for this indigenous sovereignty to survive? There are many who would take the view that it shouldn't survive, and in fact it didn't survive. So there's really not a grounding for tribal sovereignty. May have been a very nasty history, but it's part of our American history. You know, the we came, we saw, we conquered view that Native peoples are a conquered people and should not have any vitality to their aspirations to be sovereign peoples. Well, purely and simply, that's not what the law has said. The law, with some variation across time, has maintained that tribes do have a sovereign status. And so the question has been, and continues to be, what is the scope of that tribal sovereign status, and how do we reconcile it with the constitutional conventions and values that have emerged on a very parallel track, but in a different dimension? How do those two bodies of law connect? And that's what makes Indian law very fascinating to study, but very difficult to master, and certainly very difficult to administer if you are at the front line and may be unaware of the history, of the legal background, and so forth. I really feel for the frontline people, whether they are federal, state, or tribal officials, to try to get a handle on contemporary rulemaking in Indian country, because the first person they often want to run to is a lawyer, and that's always dangerous, to say, do I have the authority to do this? You know, if the tribe wants to pass a law that says X, where does that authority come from? Must it be squared with federal law? And if so, to what extent? Where does the federal authority come in to essentially dictate the terms of relations between tribes and the federal government? So I certainly understand the confusion, and I must say that after 15 weeks when my students have taken my class, they're a little more enlightened, but I don't know that the confusion is gone. I think they are still scratching their heads thinking that, you know, this is a very, very complicated picture. And there aren't too many other examples that we can point to in other parts of the world to say, well, there are indigenous peoples in other parts of the world. How do they manage to be living and operating side by side with the settler government that has usually cropped up? In their midst. I'm thinking of places like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and parts of South America, where you have the same sort of issue in terms of indigenous peoples claiming authority that is primordial, that is predating the arrival of usually European settlers.
We have a couple of other callers here. Let's talk with them and someone here on a cell phone. This was line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I've been listening to your discussion, especially on the Oliphant case. And while I agree that tribes should have some form of sovereignty, I feel like you're sort of skipping the issue of the central issue, which should be justice.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering whether you would agree with the statement whether it's not so much who does the trying of the wrongdoer, rather do they receive justice? Were they punished adequately either by the tribe or the federal government? It doesn't really matter by who, just as long as they get punished by somebody.
That's a great question, and let me say there are two quick responses to that. One is, of course, we want to be very concerned that the processes themselves are fair. That is, that whichever government goes after an alleged wrongdoer, that they have a baseline fundamental fairness that operates throughout. So, for example, we take as a constitutional norm that if anyone is going to bring charges against someone, you should have an opportunity to know those charges and to defend against those charges, an opportunity to be heard on those charges. So one part of the justice response is to make sure that tribal systems are responsive to the kinds of values that are quite typical and, in fact, constitutionally mandated if you were going before the states or the feds. Now, does that mean it has to be exactly the same way? The short answer from the federal law is that no, it doesn't, but it has to have a minimum guarantee of fairness. And the courts are still working through what that exactly means. For example, must you have a lawyer appointed to you to represent you in tribal court? That is not a requirement under the Indian Civil Rights Act, and the court in Oliphant pointed that out. They were very concerned about no counsel and no the Suquamish had a requirement that only tribal members could be on a jury, and other courts have found that to be problematic, that you weren't being tried by a jury of your peers. So those kinds of procedural issues have to be reckoned with and could contribute to the notion of justice. The second response, beyond the procedural ones, is the notion of punishment. What exactly can happen to the individual? And here's where the congressional law that I mentioned a while ago comes into play again. The Indian Civil Rights Act puts limits on the punishment that an Indian tribe can administer to anyone who is within their jurisdiction. The current limit is 1 year in prison or jail and or a $5,000 fine. And I made this point in my op-ed in the New York Times that if the tribes can only sentence someone to 1 year in jail, and if you look at what are the parallel typical verdicts for rape in state and federal court, and I spelled out what those were. I think there are 8 years in the states, over 12 on average in the federal system. Then a one-year sentence by the tribe pales in comparison to what you would get if you were sentenced by a state or a federal judge. So certainly from the victim's standpoint, that would not be a measure of justice if, in fact, the tribes were allowed to prosecute but were still operating under those severe restraints. There is a current bill in the Congress right now that is pending that would extend or enlarge the scope of sentencing authority to 3 years. I'm not sure what the prospects of that law are for passage, but that at least opens that up a little bit more. So I think that those are a couple of very important ingredients to the justice equation. What kinds of processes are operating in tribal courts, and what are the end results, the range of sanctions that a tribe can administer, and right now they're very, very limited.
Again, I want to thank the caller. We just have about 5 minutes left. We have a couple of callers here, and we'll try to get them both. And before we run out of time, we'll go next to Champagne, and this is a caller on line one. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to sort of take the conversation a little different direction and see what you think about the parallels. Recently, there have been some issues in Canada and in various European countries, United Kingdom and others, about using a parallel court system, a religious court system, whether it's Sharia law for Muslims, Orthodox Jewish law system, and various others, as a parallel and appropriate court system as a substitute for the national court system in the United States would be the state and federal court system. I don't know whether there's been any, proposals to do that in the United States. I know it occurs in the United States. I don't know the legal sanction. But I wondered, even though that's different because it's not a pre-existing sovereignty, I just wondered if you could see anything of value in talking, comparing and contrasting those systems, or if you're familiar with that.
Well, I certainly am familiar with the proposals for that. In the U.S., that would be a particularly problematic proposal in the sense that you would have a religious entity administering having administered by other bodies a religious law, and our tradition, and in fact our constitutional system of separation of church and state, would make that very, very problematic. But here's where the Indian piece gets very complicated. There are some nations, particularly in the Southwest, tribes that are theocracies, basically deriving their sense of authority in a religious context. Now, they have managed to secure the tribes back in the 1960s when Congress wrote the Indian Civil Rights Act. There was initially a prohibition against any established religion. The theocracies, the pueblos, said if we include that provision, that would essentially outlaw their form of government, and Congress took it out. So there is no prohibition against an established religion. Now, when a pueblo would prosecute someone, they're in fact using secular law. They're not using sectarian law. So there, here you have a theocracy, but they're not holding someone up to a religious standard. They're holding someone to the normative range of sanctions that operate on all members of the community. But that's a nuance there that one has to take into account. For the reason the caller said that because there's no history of prior sovereign status on a religious basis, coupled with the constitutional prohibition against separation of church and state, I think that that would be not a viable option in the U.S. at least.
Well, would it be possible, though? Can you imagine a system that of separate but more equal courts that would more closely parallel one another?
That would have a religious nature,
sectarian. That would be completely sectarian.
Secular, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I could imagine that if you had something that was an amalgam of, and there had been proposals for this over the years, is to have a separate tier of courts or specialty courts that would operate within Indian tribal communities, try to espouse or articulate what the values of that communities are, of those communities are, but at the same time be very mindful of the overarching set of values and protections that exist in U.S. law. Of course, the problem for that is, you know, who's managing those systems? Are they really tribal systems? Are they federal systems? Or are they some unique amalgam of the two? And that would need a lot more study in terms of whether or not that would be something that would advance tribes' aspirations to be self-determining nations.
One more caller here, Savoy, line 3. Hello.
Hello. Do you happen to know if William Janklow, who was formerly the Attorney General, Governor, and Congressman in South Dakota, was ever indicted for the rape of a young Lakota woman, Pine Ridge Indian, who was his babysitter?
I'm not aware.
You aren't?
I do not know.
That's
if he was ever prosecuted.
He would not, while he was Attorney General, of course, he would not recuse himself or bring charges. And, of course, you know, it was moot after he went to governor and Congress. Mm. In fact, several years ago, he killed a motorist in Minnesota while driving his motorcycle at about 90 miles an hour, you may remember.
I do remember that. That was certainly in national news.
That was William Janklow, a famous Indian hostile Indian hater from South Dakota. It would be interesting to know if he was ever indicted for the rape of that young woman.
I'll certainly look into that.
All right. Well, we're almost at the point where we have to finish. I guess I find myself thinking, and this indeed is something we could talk about some more on another occasion, though, that it seems that for the U.S. government and also for the government of Indian, particularly for the government of Indian tribes, it seems that the great challenge for them is to, as they do, want to maintain their identity, want to maintain their culture. And yet at the same time, you know, then the same question is, you know, to what extent are they going to become integrated into the life of the United States? And how exactly what do you give up? Or do you have to give up things to maintain your identity?
Right.
Or is it actually possible to continue to have some kind of dual identity?
Mm-hmm. Well, those are key issues, and in fact, since we're quite accustomed to looking at cultures through that lens, that is, what are the markers of distinctiveness that set one group distinct from others, whether it's language, religious tradition, the way that they organize their social lives and order. All of those kinds of things have obviously undergone tremendous change throughout Indian country over the last several hundred years. And those claims of inauthentic Indian identities often are made that complicate the legal picture, in the sense that people raise questions as to the bona fide claims of a community as being Indian if all their members speak English, they work in jobs that don't distinguish them from other people, they don't have traditions that would normally be the kinds that were engaged in prior to contact or even shortly after contact. All of those kinds of claims are made and complicate the situation. I think some are quite illegitimate. Some might be legitimate in terms of saying, what exactly is sovereignty protecting? My answer to that is that it's protecting the rights that tribes negotiated for from the outset in terms of political relationships with the federal government, to have the primary say in how to order their lives and to chart out their aspirations for being nations. And the complexity comes in terms of looking at the details of that. Mm. And this is simply one example of that, the scope of law enforcement authority in Indian country.
Well, there we must leave it. If, by the way, you're interested in reading some more on this subject, that is the subject of Indian law, you might look for the book, a book that our guest, Bruce Dutu, has authored that's titled American Indians and the Law, published by Viking. It's part of the Penguin Library of American Indian History. Bruce Dutu is professor of law at Vermont Law School in South Royalton, Vermont. Professor Dutu, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dave. It was my pleasure.
Today's broadcast is made possible by The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta at 114 West Church in Champaign, and staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, they'll be talking about computers. It's a show that they do every month called Computers and You. So if you are thinking about buying some new piece of equipment, hardware, software, where you're having difficulty with your computer getting it to do what you want, you can call in and pose your questions to Peter Kimball of the Center for Teaching Excellence at the U of I, and he will do his best to help you out. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. The show itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580, and Celeste Quinn is the host. In the next part of this show, we'll be talking about auto transportation and how it might change in the future. We'll have two guests joining us by phone, both with the Union of Concerned Scientists. First, though, we'll break for an update on news in the market. Stay tuned.
At 10:59 with this market update, I'm Tom Rogers. The wheat has turned lower in the first half of trading on this Monday morning, generally because of profit-taking. Also, some concerns about rising wheat supplies globally. Corn and soybeans are up, mainly on weather concerns. Right now, September wheat in Kansas City is at $8.88 a bushel, down 12. December at $9.12, down 11. In Chicago, on the CME Group board, September wheat is at $8.53, down 12.5 cents. December, $8.81, down 9.5. March also down 12 at $9.03. In the corn, September is at $5.91 a bushel, up 4.5 cents. December at $6.11 3/4, up 5 1/4. March corn, $6.30 1/2, up 4 3/4. The May is up 4 1/4 cents at $6.42. September soybeans are at $13.42 a bushel, up 21. November, $13.57 1/2, up 30 1/2. January at $13.69, up 24 1/2. March beans at $13.76, up 17 3/4. September soybean meal is at $3.67 even, that's up $6.70. And September bean oil is at $54.20, up 5. On the CME Group livestock side, August live cattle are unchanged at 101.85. October at 105.92 1/2, up 15. August feeder cattle are at 113.2.